This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners. And we have to say a very happy holiday season to you all. With the holiday season coming up, Jennifer and I are going to take a nice little break from recording the podcasts, but don't you worry, there will still be weekly episodes coming out as we share some of our favorite guests and some of the best snippets from those guests in a few best of episodes.
For example,
the best of science in your backyard.
Best of science in your backyard. How does that sound, Jeff?
I love the science in the backyard because no matter who we are and where we are, we can go out back and do it.
Exactly. So we hope you all enjoy snippets from the shows with How Did You Meet the Moths That Are in the Neighborhood by Dr. Lori Griffin Burns. How Do Super Stinky Plants Save Soil? With Dr. Colleen Kelly and one of our all-time favorites, How Are You Like a Dung Beetle? With Dr. Ann Estes.
Get ready to laugh, everybody.
How do you meet the moths that are in your neighborhood?
How do you meet moths in your neighborhood? Oh, this sounds really fun. Who is our guest today, Jeff?
Our guest today is Dr. Lori Griffin Burns. She is not only a faculty member and instructor at two different colleges in New England, she is also a scientist by training and a storyteller by inclination.
Oh, this sounds like so much fun. Welcome to the show, Dr. Lori.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with both of you.
Oh, so I'm so excited and curious about the science in your neighborhood. But what I always love to ask is, how did you start or how did you become a scientist? Like, where did your love of science come from?
Well, you know, for me, the love of science came from really great teachers. It was my high school biology teacher really inspired me to pursue a career in science.
Do you remember that biology teacher's name?
Mr. Jim Micarelli. Yes.
Of course.
Yay!
He ran a research program at our high school, which was very unusual at that time. And I did a research project on fingerprinting and a research project on earthworms, which those experiences have stayed with me all these years. And that really inspired me to go to school and be trained as a scientist myself.
All right. And so I was just about to ask why biology and not a different type of science, but having those research projects sounds a lot like lab work, so a lot less classroom instruction and more really hands-on science that started you off in high school.
Yes, absolutely. That was the case. Although I will say when I went on from there and I got more specialized in science, my degree is actually in biochemistry and I worked a lot in a research lab as a molecular biologist. And so that means I was really interested in understanding how the tiny molecules inside of our cells work. I wanted to know what those molecules were and what they did. And so later in my scientific training, I did spend a lot more time in a research lab. And then I sort of evolved again into someone who's really more interested in studying the world around me and the non-human creatures that live in it with me.
Right. And then you took all of that and turned it into writing books for kids, right?
Yes, exactly. So I was working as a scientist for quite some time. And then when I started a family and had young children of my own at home, I took a little break from that research job. Right. And it was while I was on that break that I began writing about science stories for young people because I had young people now living in my house and I was super in tune with what was interesting to them and what they wanted to know and a lot of their questions got me curious. And so really my kids pushed me into the writing, and I've now been doing that for more than 15 years, writing books about science and
wow.
science.
Love
They're amazing books. I'll just say that. They're amazing books. I've read them. Yeah.
I love the way you just said that, in that when you had kids, little people in your house, their questions sparked mm-hmm. your curiosity.
Absolutely.
That is super cool.
Yeah. And my kids were really proud of that back in the day, that they could ask questions that really inspired books. I mean, several of my books are dedicated to my kids, and they really did do a lot of the book research with me and were super instrumental in helping keep my point of view where it needed to be when I was writing about these topics for young people. You know, it's great. I miss having them around now that they're grown.
Now that they're grown and they have a completely different view. Yeah, I'm in the same boat with you. My kids have inspired me to write some of the topics that I did. But what I want to talk about is meeting moths in your neighborhood. I mean, wow, how can we do this? And why should we?
Well, I'll tackle why should we first. There are lots of answers to that question, and everyone will have their own answers to why would they like to meet the moths that live in their neighborhood. For me, it was quite simple. I began to notice, and maybe you have as well, and maybe your listeners have as well, that when I left my porch lights on at night after dark, occasionally I would leave them on too long or maybe even overnight, I would find insects around them.
Right.
And sometimes on really hot summer nights, lots of insects, flying insects. And to me, they looked moth-like. They were small in most cases. They were drab in color. Mm-hmm. They were winged. I could tell they were scaly wings. And so I knew I had moths around here, but I didn't really know much else. I didn't even know why they came to my lights. But then I gave myself an opportunity to learn a little more. That there's a nature center near to me. Nature centers are wonderful places to go and get some inspiration for work, research, studying you can do in your own backyard, in your own neighborhood green spaces. So the nature center near me was doing they were hosting a naturalist. So a man who is really focused on understanding the non-human world around him as well. And he was an expert in moths. And I thought, I will go and learn from an expert because I'm a very much a beginner, a curious beginner.
Right.
So I went to this lecture, and the man I learned from, who became a mentor for me in moth watching, his name is David Small. And he showed some incredible pictures of moths that came to his lights at his house.
Wow.
These were not small drab moths. These were incredibly diverse in color and shape and size. And he had these very close-up images where I could see the feathery antenna. I could see the individual colored scales.
That's
I could count
cool.
their legs, all those things. And I, of course, wanted to know how he did that.
How do super stinky plants save soil?
Ew. How do super stinky plants save soil? Oh, this sounds so cool. Who is our guest, Jeff?
So our guest today is Dr. Colleen Kelly. She has her PhD in, get this, organometallic chemistry, and she is a chemistry instructor at the University of Arizona.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Colleen.
Thank you, thank you. It's great to be here, Jen and Jeff.
Well, we are excited to have you, and you're going to talk about how do super stinky plants save soil. Oh. This is going to be pretty cool. First of all, what is a super stinky plant?
Thank you. First question.
First question. Super stinky plants are plants that have the element sulfur in them. So you may have cooked some broccoli or some cabbage is especially stinky and smelled that aroma. And it might smell a little bit like rotten eggs. And those are the kind of plants we're talking about today that can save soil.
And obvious second question, how does a stinky plant with that sulfur help the soil?
Well, it turns out, Jeff, that soil has contaminants in it or can have contaminants in it.
Okay.
And some of these contaminants are called heavy metals.
Oh,
and these heavy metals are pretty poisonous. You might think of lead or mercury or cadmium, and they're found in the soil. So these plants have the ability to act as tweezers and pluck up these heavy metals from the soil so that when your toddler's running around on the soil, they're not getting any lead or eating any lead. Toddlers always eat soil, it turns out. or any way else that you would be exposed to these heavy metals that are found in soil, these plants can clean up for you.
So how do they do that? Do they like grab it with their roots or soak it up through their roots?
Well, not all plants can do this, Jen. So it's only these stinky plants.
Stinky plants.
It's only these stinky plants that have a lot of sulfur in them. And their sulfur is found in the form of a molecule called a phytochelatin. And phyto means plant, and chelatin means claw. And so I like to think of them as molecules that look like tweezers. And they literally do look like tweezers when you look at their structure. So if you have a molecule that looks like a tweezer, and on the inside of the tweezer are a sulfur atom on either end, those sulfur atoms are both stinky, but they're also sticky. And they're sticky because they are magnetic. They have a minus charge, and they really, 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 really like metals like gold, mercury, cadmium, and lead.
Heavy metals.
Yes, heavy metals.
Not the music. Not the music.
Dr. Colleen just circled it around for us. So these stinky plants actually act like a magnet?
They do, yeah. So what they do is they have these tweezers in their roots. And when a metal's around, they can put them, it's called an exudate. Okay, so they emit them from the roots, grab the metal, and then bring it back up into their roots and then into their stems. And then they end up in the leaves of these plants. And so they're safely removed from the soil and they're just stored in the plants.
Why do the plants do that? Do they give them a different color or?
No, it's an evolutionary biology kind of thing where plants that were grown in soils that had these, some soils have these contaminants naturally. They just evolved over time to be able to sustain the ability to grow and flourish in soils with lead or cadmium or mercury. Okay. So these phytochelatins are around for millions and millions of years, but we've just recently discovered them because we wanted to literally get the lead out of soils. I had to put that in there.
You did.
That was awesome.
So I have an activity for our listeners. If you guys want to try to see if you can act like a phytochelatin or look like.
Oh, super.
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay, so go in your kitchen, and if you can't do this, you can at least imagine it. So go in your kitchen and grab some salad tongs.
Okay.
Right? And the other thing you'll need is a tennis ball or a baseball, and then a basketball or some kind of bigger ball, like a playground ball or a soccer ball.
All right.
Okay, so now you have in your hand the salad tongs. Those are that's a phytochelatin. Mm-hmm. And on the end of the tongue are two sticky, stinky sulfur atoms.
Okay.
Right? Now try to grab the tennis ball or the baseball with that. And so you probably can, right? They're about the right size.
Yeah.
So you can grab that. Okay. Now try to grab your basketball or soccer ball with the same pair of tongs. Will it fit?
No.
No.
Uh-huh.
See, that's the thing with these phytochelatins. They're not for all metals. So not only do the metals have to be the right charge, which is a plus charge, but they have to be the right size. So the phytochelatins are specific for lead, cadmium, and all these nasty heavy metals because they have the right size too. So one size, it's a little bit like Goldilocks. You have to have the right size.
Okay.
And the right charge.
I like that. I like that.
Very good.
How are you like a dung beetle?
Oh, how are you like a dung beetle? Oh, this is going to be good. This is going to be so good. Who is our guest today, Jeff?
Today we have Dr. Ann Estes, and she is the Jess and Mildred Fisher Endowed Professor of Biological Sciences at Towson University.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Ann.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here with y'all.
So your question is, this is so cool. How are you like a dung beetle? Are we going to talk about how humans and dung beetles might be similar?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, okay. So we have to ask the question we ask everybody. First of all, why dung beetles? If you could study anything, why'd you pick them?
Well, dung beetles are amazing. They are on every continent in the earth, except for Antarctica, and that's too cold for me anyway. They have lots of different ways of living. They sometimes, you've seen pictures, right, of the rollers, right? They get all the press. Well, we have rollers that live in the poop, and then we have tunnelers that live under the poop. And honestly, do you want to have a lot of poop around?
No.
I mean, dung beetles do us this huge service by recycling all those nutrients that the host, you know, the animal at first ate stuff, couldn't eat. But really, it's not the dung beetles. The real trick is with the microbes.
Oh.
Oh.
Tell us more. This is small, like even smaller and smaller.
Yeah, you know the number of stars in your galactic space, right? Well, we've got just as many numbers in our microbial world.
Very true. Very true. We're talking billions or even trillions of microbes in like animals, like a human body, correct?
That's right. So my true love is studying how these crazy things work together, right? Because you think, these little invisible microbes, what do? Well, they've driven our whole entire planet from the get-go, and they help us as well inside of our bodies, on our bodies, and every other organism in the world. But what's so neat to me is that we have these teeny different little things that really are working together with our big bodies. And it's only those two things coming together. And we see this time and time again with squid and jellyfish and all sorts of other creatures.
Okay.
These really different things, they come together to form a super organism.
Oh.
We like to say mutualism is 1 + 1 = 3.
Oh, very good.
Oh.
Very good. So how are dung beetles and microbes, how do the two of those combine in your world?
With our dung beetles, they're feeding on poop, right? Which again is something that has already been processed by an animal. It's so crazy, right? Most people have heard about cows and how they have a lot of different stomachs, right? They got
okay, yeah.
They chew their cud, right? So they throw up their food and they eat it again. Then
hey, gross, right? Sometimes science is messy, everybody.
Thanks for the visual there, Dr. Ann.
You're welcome. I'm always really crappy and poopy and gross, okay? That's just my biz. And we'll get some farts in too, I promise.
But super.
One of those stomachs even has this crazy community, right, of flagellates and ciliates and bacteria and fungi, all this stuff. But it still can't eat the food that all the nutrients from the grass.
Okay.
In a cow plop, if you go, you know, flip over a cow.
Sure.
Plop, I do sure. Much, or a horse poop, or, you know, any other kind of animal, your dog poop even, you might see a little hole underneath the poop that's about the size of a pencil or a little bit smaller. If you're really, really lucky, it's about an inch wide, and that means you've got a rainbow dung beetle probably, and they're gorgeous. So if you flip that over and you see those little holes, these are the tunnels produced by the tunneling dung beetles. And beneath your feet, like 3 foot down, right?
Okay.
Beetles are, they're about, if they're the black beetles that I study, the bull-headed dung beetles.
Okay.
Well, I made my antenna there. They're the size of your pinky fingernail. And what they're doing is they're taking a little bit of poop from that cow plop, and they're bringing it down into the tunnels into a special little place called a nursery room. And in this nursery room, they're setting up a little ball of dung for their babies.
Aww. Okay. I mean,
that sounds so sweet.
That's a great gift. Like, all right. Hey.
The parents, sometimes it's just the mom. Sometimes it's mom and dad working together. It depends on the species. But they're going to push and mold this poop to form a little round room called egg chamber. And the mom is, when it's, you know, the big brood ball, which is what we call the majority of this. So okay. This brood ball, one side of it is going to be a circular chamber. The circular chamber, mom is using her special little mouth parts And she's pushing and spitting and trying to make these walls all gorgeous for her baby in this brood chamber. So once she's made her nursery beautiful, she's going to go to the bottom of this and she's going to poop.
Of course. I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah. There's so much poop in this story, okay? It makes me happy.
Your backyard is a great place to enjoy some science. We really hope you enjoyed those snippets. And Jennifer, tell them where they can listen to the full episodes.
Well, don't forget to go to our website, solveitforkids.com, or anywhere that you listen to your podcast, like Spotify or iTunes.
And don't forget to listen to us next week on Solve It for Kids.